Snack Bar Games Podcast.
Welcome to the Snack Bar Games Podcast. This is episode 261. I'm Graham.
And I'm Sean. How's it going, Graham?
Not bad. It's been an interesting week. A lot of yelling. People need to stop yelling at each other, especially on the internet.
Yeah, there was a lot of yelling on the internet this week.
And we'll get to some of that later, but
I'm not saying something.
Yeah, it just seemed like this week especially, I just wanted to just get off the internet and just not be on the internet. It was the worst. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It wasn't the best of times because it was just the worst of times. How are you, Sean?
I'm doing all right.
Yeah?
Started at my first Dungeons & Dragons campaign today. And yeah. I'm the paladin. I'm the tank for the party. Everyone else is a rogue or something. Or okay. Mage. I almost got one shot killed by a zombie in the first crit, in the first encounter.
Okay.
I walked in, the guy crits me and takes all but one of my health.
Okay.
That's Dungeons & Dragons.
Yep. Since this is your first D&D campaign, I got to warn you, the one thing people don't want to hear you talk about is the like in-world mechanics and story of your D&D campaign, if they're not in your D&D campaign.
Makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah. So just you know, but that was a good story. It was nice of you to share your world with us. Joining us on this episode, Lucas. Hey, Lucas, how's it going?
Hey, it's going all right.
What's happening in Lucas Land?
I came into a little bit of money and blew a large portion of it at GameStop like a big dummy.
Brewster's but, hundreds.
What? I don't know what.
Never mind.
Okay, sorry.
And that was Chris Dominowski. Hey, Chris Dominowski. How's it going?
Hey, how's it going?
You got my dumb joke, didn't you? Thank you. Wait.
Yes, actually, I did.
See?
I did.
It was a dumb joke. So what's going on with you?
I just got back from my state's Maker Faire event today, and I was with a bunch of friends and had a really great time.
Did you make something?
Unfortunately, no, but I did get a lot of ideas for making stuff.
Okay.
I may try my hand again at making a portable GameCube. That's something I've always wanted to do, but something I've always failed miserably at.
Yeah, I remember back in the GameCube days, I had this like attachment with the screen at the top. Which was, I guess, kind of common. But then, very briefly, like, the same company made a battery pack.
I know, I've been trying to track one of those down. That seems so cool.
Yeah, so what happened with the battery pack is all of the... The one thing you couldn't do with the battery pack is sit it down on something. And it was on the bottom of the GameCube. So
those things melt or something like ridiculously?
Yes, mine and almost everyone else's just melted and warped and stopped working. But hey, I mean,
you couldn't play Game Boy Player in the bottom, so
yeah.
The dream of playing Game Boy Advance games on the go
on
will
the go.
Forever remain elusive.
Yeah. I admit to trying to get that to work.
I'm proud of you. I'm very proud of you.
You could still do it if you plugged it in with the car. That was good. All you get is a slightly larger screen with a worse refresh rate. It's great. Oh, man. Anyway.
But you can play Wind Waker on the go. Wasn't that the coolest thing ever?
I didn't play Wind Waker on the go. I played Kirby Air Ride on the go. That's pretty
good. Sounds a lot better.
Yeah.
You should have played it in land mode on the go. That would have been something.
Oh, man. What if everybody had screens? That would have been great.
If you just, like...
Should
got
just
like
have a
three, four cars curve. And like found some empty parking lot and just set that up. That would be pretty sweet.
Yeah.
Generally, good things do not happen, you know, alone in empty parking lots, but that would be a good thing.
True. All right. Let's go ahead and move on to news. Sean, what's going on in the world of games?
Well, let's start with something that people have been hearing rumors about for a while, and that's that we would get a new Strider game soon. And Capcom finally announced one.
Yeah.
So, we will have Double Helix working on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which I gather is less exciting.
My understanding is that the kind of brain. Oh my God. Sorry. The guys that are important because of the first two Strider games are still involved, and Double Helix is just kind of doing the grunt work. That's what I've heard.
That would be nice.
Yeah.
Very good news.
Let me ask you guys, did you guys play Moondiver?
I wanted to, but I never got to it.
Because it's kind of a like a new Strider for like these consoles. Well,
so I've heard.
PS3 anyway.
Do you recommend it then?
I actually reviewed it when it came out, I guess what, like 3 years ago now. But yeah, so when people are like, oh, there's a new Strider, I was like, wasn't there a new Strider? Oh, right, they didn't call it Strider because it was a different, you know, like it's Square Enix, so they couldn't call it Strider. But it like had like the same attacks and like, yeah, so I don't know. A new Strider could be interesting. Yeah,
I'm psyched.
Yeah. I'll have to wait until we actually get it. Or at least see some of it. But you know, hey, bring back Strider, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, Capcom needed to make a game to please people who like its old 2D action platformer games. And
the
Strider.
Star of the robot.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Sean, what else is going on?
All right. We also got another game getting a remake, which is Soul Calibur 2 HD Online.
Yeah. It's online.
It's online.
Yeah.
And it's back.
That is a thing that exists.
Yeah. So it's going to be based on the PS2 version. Because.
Heihachi.
Yeah. Because, you know, okay. Namco Bandai owns Heihachi and doesn't own Spawn or Link.
Right.
So, you know, there's that. But, you know, hey, Soul Calibur 2, when they're online mode, sounds pretty good. I like Soul Calibur 2 a lot. I think it may be my favorite so far as just straight up fighting. 3 and 4, if you played them, they were interesting for their, I don't know, their campaign elements, their customization, stuff like that. But just pure fighting, there's something about 2.
Soul Calibur 2 definitely had the best response, probably, or the biggest response.
Well, definitely that, because it was multi-platform, you know.
I'd argue that the original one had more of an impact, just because it was one of the Dreamcast big titles. It was arguably, other than Sonic Adventure, the biggest title at launch, and probably one of the most graphically advanced titles to ever be released for the system, which is unheard of at a system's launch.
No,
it was also on the Dreamcast.
Yeah, I mean that's the thing. It was really great, but if you think about like significance in the industry as a whole, the Dreamcast honestly didn't sell like to enthusiasts like us, like Soul Calibur for the Dreamcast, absolutely, but as far as sales it wasn't that great. And then when they went multi-platform and when Link got put in the GameCube version, like Soul Calibur 2, really the reason Soul Calibur still exists is Soul Calibur 2.
Yeah,
okay, that's a fair point.
Yeah,
I'm wondering how much, like, how this game's gonna last, if it'll have legs.
I don't know, you know?
Because, like, there's still the fan base, but 4 and 5 kind of came out, and then they were there, and 5 especially seemed to just disappear pretty quickly.
Yeah, well, I mean, 5, I think, really retreated back to its base, because it focused on making, you know, online matchmaking and stuff, like, a really big deal. So the single player campaign was like an unfinished one of the characters' stories, and then they
stopped. Weird.
And like 2/3 of the cutscenes are just like storyboard sketches. it's not even trying to cover it up. So there was a lot of that where like normal people who play games, if they weren't going to play super competitively online, they're done, and they would, you know, you don't hear people talk about it. But
okay,
yeah, I like the story focused stuff better. But, you know.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people that didn't really care about fighters otherwise played Soul Calibur 2. So
absolutely, yeah. I mean, and again, Chris, you're right. The original Soul Calibur, if people had access to Dreamcast, that was really a cool thing at the time. More so than, you know, your standard. I mean, whatever, the Dreamcast had Dead or Alive and Street Fighter and a whole bunch of stuff, but Soul Calibur was like the game normal people would play.
did the HD release of the first game do well? I kind of stopped.
I kind of heard that.
People don't talk about it a whole lot.
And it's because it didn't have online.
Apparently, it sold well enough to be relevant.
Yeah.
Okay.
So yeah, it was kind of a bare bones port, but I mean, people loved Soul Calibur, and getting it back was nice. So that was kind of how that went. But everybody's like, well, I'll hold out for Soul Calibur 2, and maybe they'll put online in that one. So that's what they did. Anyway,
so there's a chance this could be a little more than just something that's there for.
Probably just going to be there.
Yeah.
if we're being honest, but hey, you know, it'll be fun. If people haven't played Soul Calibur 2, or really any Soul Calibur game, an HD version of Soul Calibur 2 might be the way to get going. Anyway, yeah. John, what else is going on in Newsland?
We also have another Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles game coming this year.
Yeah.
Yes. This one is a side-scroller, action brawler.
Yeah.
Which, the downside is it's based on the new series.
Well, that's not really a downside.
I mean, it's not going to be based on anything but the new series. It's the only...
Well, right, but I mean, I don't really like the art of the new series.
Sure. What bothers me about this is that the platforms for this game are 360, Wii, and PS.
Yeah, that's weird.
Which suggests to me that Wii is a lead platform when it does that, because it's fairly easy to port a Wii game to 3DS, and it's super easy to port a Wii game to 360. It's kind of, you know, if you were doing a 360 game, you'd probably also put it on PS3.
The one that's coming out sooner is definitely for the older audience far too seriously.
Yeah,
so I can see this one being on the Wii because it's aimed at the kids.
Yeah, and you know, it could be good. Really, it just has to recreate the old arcade games. That's all it has to do.
I mean, I watched the trailer and it looked kind of like the one on the GameCube when the other new cartoon came out, except a little more active.
Battle Nexus.
The first one.
Okay,
but a little more arcadey, a little more frantic, more going on the screen. So.
Well, I mean, you know, look, that's fine, I guess.
And you play as the turtles, you mash the buttons, the robots fall down. It'll probably be fun.
I guess. If you're doing a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles game and you don't make it like the arcade game, I don't know what you're doing. You know what? I would respect you if for some reason you made a game where you just had to defuse bombs and water. But I'd hate you, but I'd respect you for it. But, you know, like this, like generic action game, like why? There's this template and there's this nostalgia associated with this formula that works. Jump and then you kick and then you jump and then you kick.
I mean, that's what it looks like, just in a 3D space.
And sometimes you use nunchucks.
Yeah.
That should be the game, right? But nah, whatever. I will.
Only if you're crazy enough to use Michelangelo.
Brawlers are kind of in funky territory ever since things went 3D. So,
yeah, and we're gonna talk about that in the next month or two.
As soon as I get back on that.
But yeah, we got some content in the works for early fall. Keep an eye out. But anyway, I'll reserve judgment on a new TMNT game until I see it.
I'm more interested in that one than the Shadows one, because it's less hideous.
Yeah, it's just sad because the last few attempts at making a good TMNT game had promise when you talked about them. Like, hey, what if we hire the guys who made Smash Brothers to make a Smash Brothers game? Well, okay, that seems like a good idea. Or hey, what if we just recreate screen for screen Turtles in Time? Well, yes, that's kind of what I want, but that didn't work out either. So, yeah. I don't know. I just wait till the thing's in our hands and judge then.
Yep.
John?
All right. Well, speaking of a game that reportedly will never get in our hands, Fez 2 was canceled by Phil Fish, I think Friday, after a Twitter argument with game trailers.
With everyone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
After a 3-year Twitter argument with everyone, Phil Fish decided.
Oh, Fish. I respect the guy. I really respect the guy. And I really liked Fez. And I saw Indie Game, the movie. I saw his interviews. He seems like a guy that's really stressed out. And
yeah.
You know,
he seems like a guy who'd be hard to
deal
with.
He does, but there's something about to say for professionalism in this industry. And
yeah.
Even if you do have a short fuse, and I understand having a short fuse, I kind of do myself, but you got to hold yourself to a higher standard no matter who you are.
Yeah, or even, like, I mean, really, especially, you know, in tech and entertainment and games, there are all these brilliant people that are just infuriating, but their work is great, you know? So.
Exactly.
That's perfectly fine as long as you realize you're infuriating and just be infuriating privately. Like, I mean, yes, Fez was great. I don't think anyone else could have made Fez, you know? That was totally Phil Fish. We would not have anything like it if it weren't for him. But, and I even kind of respect some of his opinions when he says them in, like, the least tactful way possible, and then he yells for a few days, and then he calls everyone idiots. Like, the original points, yes, Japanese games need to evolve and pay attention to some things that they've been ignoring for a long time. That's a good point. You know, maybe he didn't need to insult people to their face. You know, there are way better ways to say it. But, yeah, like, you know, like, in this situation, yeah, people said some really horrible things to him. And probably shouldn't have done that. But, you know, it's just, it's unfortunate. Because I would like to play Fez 2, and I think if he just, you know, made Fez 2, then everybody would appreciate him, and, you know, he just, yeah, I don't know. It's a rough situation. People should just be nice to each other.
Yeah, and, like, from his perspective, I can kind of see why he not kind of was angry and, you know, does his thing where he's angry and loud all the time, but why he got fed up and left, because the dude does kind of get harassed on a daily basis.
Yeah.
Like, that's it may or may not be his fault,
right?
Depending on the situation, but it's still like thousands of angry gamers constantly going after him because, you know, it's always like, oh, Phil Fish said this thing by the press, and then,
well,
it just seems like one of those popular things that probably happens from other people too, because Phil Fish said the one thing that one time, people keep going after him, and
yeah.
It's just a rough situation all around, really.
Yeah, I mean,
like I said, you gotta have thick skin in this business.
Yeah, and I mean, honestly, Phil Fish is not the only guy who's like Phil Fish, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I guess the most obvious other person in the industry is Hideki Kamiya.
Yeah.
Just like, well, yep, you just mouth off to everyone all the time. But, I mean, I don't know why that seems better. It's, I don't know, you know? Like, maybe it's just because he, like, responds once very rudely and then just stops, you know,
drops
as it, I think Phil Fish just kind of snowballs, which is whatever. I've done that in my everyday life. I just haven't done it publicly, and I haven't done it while making one of arguably, and I'll probably make the argument, one of the best games of the generation.
I also it's think rough. There's something to be said for what started this particular incident.
Yeah. So you want to go into that?
I'd like to. Yeah.
Yeah.
So should I recap or?
Yeah.
Go ahead. I didn't see much of what was going on beforehand.
The annoyed gamer on game trailers.
Is he an angry Kirby?
Went to John Blow and Phil Fish when the Xbox One kind of doing self-publishing indie games was more of a rumor right before it was confirmed. And he asked them for a comment, and they both refused because they didn't want to comment on a rumor.
Right.
And then the guy made his next video and basically publicly called them out and said some pretty terrible things about them.
Yep.
In response.
Can they really be, I mean, can you really ask them to speak for that sort of thing anymore? I mean, it's, when you say it now, of course it sounds ridiculous, but they all the big 360 indie publishers have kind of moved over to PC, so. And still, they're just indies. They're not huge partners with Microsoft. Even Even if they were huge partners with Microsoft, how could they possibly have the authority to speak on such a thing?
And yeah. Even then, that's just a really ethically bankrupt thing to do.
It really is. I agree.
Oh, man. Yeah. So. Yeah, like it's totally out of line, it's, and you know, yeah,
bad everywhere.
Yeah, it's yeah, and like and you know, I guess I'd be mad if I hadn't already resigned myself to the fact that most of the internet is worthless. But man, like yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure it gets a lot of traffic, and that's the rough thing too, is all of this scandal. Guess what? Everybody's like going to game trailers for this.
Mm-hmm.
They're making money off being obnoxious.
Yeah.
So sensationalist journalism. Try your best to avoid it.
Yeah.
Don't encourage it.
Yeah. Don't feed it after midnight.
Keep fighting the good fight.
Yeah. Anyway, so, you know, it's a bit of a downer topic. You know, bad things followed worse things. But hey, this was all based on another piece of news, Sean.
Oh, that would be that Microsoft is going to allow self-publishing for everyone. They say that eventually every Xbox One will be able to be its own development kit, which is quite interesting.
That's pretty cool.
Okay, I might give props to Microsoft for that.
I might mess around with it a little bit after that, but once it's up, if someone gives me one.
Now, there's some questions that we still need to ask about this news. First off is the wording behind the statement. Now, technically, because of the tools Microsoft has released for the Xbox 360, technically every 360 can be used as a commercial development kit by the user through a series of circumstances. So,
right,
they
X and
could
A.
Just be doing the same thing. Yeah, X and A. They could be doing the same thing. We don't know if there's any actual change in policy yet. That's something we got to keep in mind. Either way, it's a good thing for Microsoft to clarify that they will be they'll at least be continuing the same thing that they did into the next generation.
Well, the main thing is the self-publishing thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's something to be excited about.
Even on the 360, if you went on the indie game store, they were publishing it for you. They took 30 or 70% of the profits.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and that was the thing, because you couldn't make any money there. But yeah, even now, it's still not confirmed as of our recording that this is also going to roll out to 360. But it's confirmed to be the case for Xbox One, which is great just for, you know, there are all these indie games that didn't make it on there because they had to find a publisher and get a slot. Like, there are all these indie games where, you know, they would publish by themselves on, you know, Steam, publish by themselves on PSN. And then for some reason, like, you know, they teamed up with Atlas, or, you know, teamed up with Majesco, or some weird, like, hey, we have to publish with these guys. And that just was a huge barrier to getting your game on the system. But that's not going to be there anymore, which is it's a positive. It's a positive thing.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I have had experience with the XNA side of Xbox development, which is, I actually did that for my senior project in college. The XNA tools have been discontinued by Microsoft.
Yeah.
They are, it's basically gone. And the way it worked when you were developing on the Xbox 360 was actually you built everything on your PC and then streamed it to your 360 to see how it would run on it. You didn't actually use the 360 for anything other than to test your builds. And then whenever it worked fine, you could try to publish it or send it out through the indie channel or whatever.
And the fact that it's open makes a lot of sense tied in with that we're getting rid of XNA thing.
Yeah.
Just be like, no, we don't need to keep you in the kiddie pool. When it was first announced without any of this self-publishing stuff, it was like, you're just cutting off your system. But this explains that in a much more logical way, or at least retroactively explains it if that wasn't the initial idea.
Yeah, and we shouldn't have to wait too long to hear anything else. They said they're going to give us more information, I think, at Gamescom.
Yeah, so it was supposed to be a Gamescom announcement.
Yeah.
But it got leaked and then confirmed, which was good. That was good for Microsoft. Just confirm things when they get out.
They get something good out there.
Yeah. And I mean, honestly, it's only a few months until we have those systems. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know what's interesting? and this is kind of branching off a little bit, but with Microsoft making all these huge changes to, in just a crisis effort in order to get some good PR in the works, and then just changing all the things that people didn't like about the Xbox One, it's kind of putting it more, now that's putting it more and more on parity with the PlayStation 4, I'm kind of wondering about what this next generation is really going to be defined by in terms of consoles. I mean, the third-party exclusive is pretty much all but dead now, at least in my opinion, and hardware specs for the PS4 and Xbox One are pretty much just going to be x86 PCs, and yeah, really, what's going to be much left to define these consoles?
Yes, the third-party exclusive isn't really a thing, but, you know, Microsoft's thing is to basically buy third-party games. And, you know, in the previous generation, it was mainly trying to pay for exclusivity for parts of things or timed exclusivity or things like that. But you can see with Dead Rising 3, like, Dead Rising 3 is being published by Microsoft. I think we're going to see a lot more of that.
I hope so. Exclusive titles, at least in my opinion, are what give a system its personality. It's right. What allows clear distinction between one system and the next. I mean, right. Back in the 16-bit days, pretty much almost everything out there was an exclusive unless it was a popular arcade port.
Right, and even then, were made by different companies and were like complete reworkings of the arcade build or things like that. Even things that seemed similar were totally different.
People still fight today whether which console got the best version of Street Fighter 2.
Yeah, I mean, the idea of a real multi-platform game didn't come about until, I guess PS1 and 64 had a lot of stuff like that. And that was always weird because those weren't feature identical because, you know, the PS1 had, you know, extra room for movies and sounds, and the 64 had a little better processing power, and it just got messy. But, I mean, once we got to PS2, Xbox, GameCube, that was the point where it was like, okay, well, these are all the same game. I don't know, what shape controller do you like better, you know? So, I don't know. I mean, we're going to have a lot of that this time because things are going to be feature identical. It's not going to be this issue where the PS3 can, you know, pump out things at a little higher resolution but can't keep up with objects as well. You know, like, that's not going to be an issue anymore. So, the PS3 was defined by its first-party content anyway. And the 360 was defined by what it paid to get quicker. I mean, it's totally, you know, you bought a 360 this generation because you cared about multiplayer content, because it was more stable and it was, you know, more people were there.
Well said.
Or Halo, I guess. It's still going to have Halo. That's a thing.
Yeah, it's still going to have Halo.
Yeah. But more so next generation, because the Kinect is going to be built in, I think you're going to see Kinect shaped experiences that aren't necessarily full crazy motion things, but just more subtle uses of it to
different. Yeah, I hope so. I think the Kinect really isn't as bad as people say. I mean, I really am certainly not the biggest fan of Microsoft, as I've made clear in the past.
Oh, really? You don't like Microsoft?
Yeah, I know. Breaking news, right?
Wow.
But anyway, I actually use my Kinect quite a bit. I use one of the exercise games, at least for it, like, once or twice a day, and I'm actually still a big fan of what the peripheral can do.
Yeah,
I mean, it's just a matter of whether that'll pan out or not. And now that it's going to be bundled with the Xbox One, we'll be able to see if it really lives up to that potential.
Yeah. Anyway, all right. So, Sean, let's do one more news item and move on.
All right. How about we go with Earthbound finally coming out?
Sound the trumpets.
Yeah.
Yes. Happy news.
I don't have any trumpets. Do you have trumpets? Okay. Who had the trumpets?
I had the trumpets.
Okay, good. Somebody had the trumpets.
I also have a tuba somewhere.
Okay, don't sound the tuba. Was that wasn't a tuba. It was you making a tuba sound.
Yeah, it was.
Okay.
Anyway, Earthbound.
Yes. So,
I have not downloaded it yet. I need to.
I got it day one. I was super excited.
I'm gonna get it. Earthbound. I just haven't. haven't picked it up yet because I want to like buy it and then immediately start playing it. And right now is really rough for me because I got a few things on my plate, but I'm absolutely going to get it at some point.
Yeah, I bought it day one, but I've been playing through FF6 on the virtual console right now. And I really, really need to finish one RPG Super Nintendo Classic before I start another RPG Super Nintendo Classic.
Okay, you got that slot in your...
I only have so much space that I can dedicate to RPGs, and I just finished Dragon Warrior 1 last night after over 10 years of trying.
Okay.
So I'm very proud of that. But only have so much space in my gaming roster.
Yeah, I understand that. I only have room for three... portable card-based RPGs at any given time.
You got to make room somewhere, man.
I mean, one of them is permanently SNK versus Capcom Card Fighters in the Neo Geo Pocket Color. So that's
yes.
Just...
Nice. I would I'm going to virtual high five you right now.
Okay.
There you go.
Okay. Yeah. Sure.
3, 2, 1. High five. That's a virtual high five.
Okay, but Earthbound. yeah. So. You know, it's nice that it was finally here. Was kind of, you know, sudden. It seemed like with all the fanfare, it would be more fanfare. But I think
it does
also
have a really fancy trailer on the
That trailer was really cool. If you guys haven't seen the trailer, they did some cool, you know, 3D pixel art shenanigans.
I need to watch that.
Yeah.
I like that they released the strategy guide that came with the original game.
Yeah, absolutely.
I forgot about that.
Yeah, you can access it through the gamepad while you're playing the game. That's a really nice touch.
And it's nice and optimized. So it has the buttons on the side. And yeah, that's really cool. I wish it were a little easier. Like, I wish you could run it on the gamepad while you're playing the game.
And, you can? I thought you could.
Well, yeah, I mean, you have to bring up the browser, right?
Oh, well, that's no big deal. You just pause the game. It's an RPG. Yeah, yeah. It's like... it's time critical.
Yeah, absolutely. I was just thinking, like, you know, if you could be running it live while you're playing,
that would be nice. Cool.
But you know, hey, that's not a huge deal. It's super nice that they did that. It was a nice touch. And it's somewhat justified it being a premium price. I don't know what sort of, you know, I don't know if there was a licensing involved.
It'd be nice for that information to come out somewhere, but probably won't.
Yeah, it won't.
Yeah.
You know, Japanese companies don't ever share that information with anyone, including their own employees.
So, they're very good at keeping it, but they never share it.
Yeah. But hey, look, we got Earthbound. That was great.
Nice to be able to.
He started clamoring for Mother 3. It's like, wait like 10 minutes. Guys. Just 10 minutes. Give me 10 minutes.
They were throwing their translations at Nintendo. Please take them.
Well, one thing I thought Nintendo might have been waiting for with releasing this was implementing some sort of gift functionality, because I know how crazy Earthbound fans are, and if you gave them the ability to buy one copy for all their friends and send it to them like you could like with Wii games, I'm surprised that doesn't exist yet, but I have a lot more copies.
That would require Nintendo to actually... upgrading their network and community infrastructure.
Sure. I just, you know, since you could already do it on the Wii, it's a little weird that you can't do that. And
that's the story of the system's life so far.
Yeah, but anyway, it's cool that we have Earthbound. Also weird that at the exact same time we got Shantae.
Yay!
So no one could pay attention to Shantae again.
Oh,
poor Shantae.
Okay, I pay attention to Shantae.
Why does Nintendo hate Shantae?
And how about we segue there into our game section where I start off by talking about Shantae? Would that be all right?
Sure.
Yay.
Let's talk about playing Shantae.
I am playing Shantae.
It came out in, like 12 years ago. So, how's that game for people? Yeah, you know what? It came out in such a small quantity that we can talk about Shantae. So, people who were interested in Shantae have probably checked out Risky's Revenge on DSiWare.
That was a day one purchase for me.
But so, for those people, what does Shantae offer?
Well, it was one of the first real portable Metroidvania games, at least in my opinion, that wasn't obviously Metroid or Castlevania.
I was going to say, we did have Circle of the Moon at that point.
So. Yeah, Circle of the Moon was a GBA launch title. Yeah. I mean, like, actual, that wasn't Metroid or Castlevania.
I mean, we were at that in that era, it was still a thing where I don't know if the name had been truly coined yet, because there was really what just Symphony of the Night before that. I guess I should say
it was one of the first portable ones.
Yeah,
yeah.
But like at that point, it was still largely dominated by those two franchises, and that was why it got named that. But yeah, it's a nice exploration platformer.
And it has gorgeous graphics. I mean, oh my gosh, it looked like an early GBA title. It is just fantastic. Just
quite like an early GBA title because it, like,
okay, the resolution gives it away, but still, you have to admit, it looks damn good on the Game Boy Color.
It's interesting that it re-releases the same week as Earthbound, because I think both of them had the same problem, that they both look great now because they had signature aesthetics, but then people were a little too focused on, like, just visual quality, just, you know, graphical power. But it looks, it's well crafted, especially when you go back to other Game Boy Color games. Like, this looks horrible. It plays fine, but it looks horrible. But Shantae was going for a very specific thing, and it does it really well.
Mm-hmm. I'm a huge fan of WayForward, so I follow everything that they do. And
let's see where we draw the line. How do you feel about Double Dragon Neon?
Oh no.
Okay.
Am I ever gonna live that down? Ever?
I'm kind of with you.
I am not blind.
Yeah.
I am not blind, so I'm going to have to give two thumbs down, possibly a third if I had a third hand, to Double Dragon Neon.
You're saying being exposed to Double Dragon Neon didn't, like, make you radioactive and grow a third arm?
I'll have to check, but as of now, it's just two thumbs down.
Okay. I'm with you, Lucas. I actually kind of liked it, but it seemed like that's the I like Way Forward, but game.
That's weird.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because, like, when
I'm
it
not a big fan
first
of the
came
Blood
out,
Rain game, but people seem to like that one. I don't know.
Liked it.
Yeah. Batman the Brave and the Bold was pretty good.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that was a fun one.
Duck Amuck. We got some Duck Amuck fans around here.
Play that.
I've never even heard of it.
It's a DS game that's based on that cartoon where, like, you know, there's the cartoonist and Daffy Duck kind of fighting with each other. Anyway, it's fun. But anyway, I bring that up and then the Way Forward conversation ends. But yeah, so you know, for people who are used to the complexity and, you know, amount that was in Risky's Revenge, does Shantae still hold up fine, or is it largely kind of if you really want more, there's more Shantae, or if you really liked it back in the day, you get Shantae? Thoughts?
If you want to get a good opinion on Shantae, if you want to know if it still holds up, just look at the price tag, what it's going for on eBay right now, and that should tell you everything you need to know.
Well, let me tell you, if quality is based on how much it gets on eBay, let me tell you about this really high quality game called Stadium Events. You just hit a button a whole bunch, and then a number goes up, and that's the whole game. But you that's get to hit the button with your feet, unless you're wanting to win, and then you just hit it with your hands a whole bunch. So, yeah.
Right. Fair point. But
yeah, that is one of those games that people really wanted to play, and you can get it for $5 now. So just get it for $5, because come on.
Yeah.
Though, I mean, hey, look, if you only have enough to pay for one of them, go ahead and get Risky's Revenge. That one's pretty good. But yeah, I mean, you know, if you are a person who would buy Virtual Console games on your 3DS, that's probably one that you should get.
How's the soundtrack in a pre-Vert Way Forward?
Because I haven't actually played it. It holds up pretty darn well. I mean, it's got a really cool Arabian theme to the soundtrack. Shantae is a genie, so that makes sense.
Right.
Half genie, sorry.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where if there was one thing the Game Boy Color did really badly, it was sound, because it was still running. You know, it didn't have any better sound than the 1989 Game Boy, you know?
Right.
So there was very little you could do there. So I'm betting it's going to, I mean, if it's inoffensive, that's about as good as the Game Boy could do natively. Without,
yeah, given that it is on the Game Boy Color, it's still pretty impressive. It's still pretty catchy. And yeah, I actually really like it.
Cool.
Fair enough.
All right. What?
All right. Next up, it looks like Lucas, you have been hacking and slashing and hacking and slashing and hacking and slashing in Dynasty Warriors 8. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
See, that's not anything new. you know how you have your 16-bit RPG thing in your rotation? I believe Lucas has at least one slot for 3D hack and slash from Omega Force.
Actually, haven't played a lot of the traditional Dynasty Warriors games in a while.
Yeah, though I don't blame you because generally since, I mean, what, about, I mean, 5 was all right, but since then, the first basic Dynasty Warriors game is kind of when they make a new engine and then they make spinoffs and Orochi games and things like that built on those engines, but they've polished them some. So, like, playing the original Dynasty Warriors is always kind of a, it's been kind of a weird thing for about a generation now, but 8 seems different.
Yeah, so so I've mostly kind of been finding myself playing all the goofy anime spinoffs. So this is the first time in a while I've gotten into the traditional Dynasty Warriors, and it's pretty awesome. First of all, exactly. Oh my god, there is this scene in the intro, a guy's like coming through on these boats and blowing them all up and stuff, and then like a horse comes literally barreling from the side of the screen in midair, and he like mounts it while it's spinning, and he like stabs some guys with a spear, jumps off the horse. The horse is still running, and he's holding on to the horse's tail, sliding like a freaking like jet ski. It's like, oh, that's why you should play Dynasty Warriors 8.
You can clearly see that they strike historical accuracy.
Can you do that while you're playing, or only in cutscenes?
No, only in cutscenes. Though there is a cool new horse mechanic for fans that if you hold on to the call your horse button, you can jump on it automatically, which saves.
That's super good because previously you hit the button and then the horse came around you somewhere, but not necessarily within your field of view. So you had to look around and see where the horse was and then walk over to it and then hope someone wasn't right next to it trying to hit you or trying to like distract your attention. So the mounted horse button was instead slash a guy or hold on to it and be on the horse. That's the best.
So this makes getting across the bigger areas and going after your mission objectives that tend to pop up on the opposite side of the map a lot more of a pleasant experience.
I know that they've rebuilt the engine some, so it can actually have larger, more filled worlds.
Yeah, from what I've read, it's a new engine. They did a lot of stuff with the lighting. They built every character from scratch, which is one of the big things about this game.
There are like 90 of them.
Yeah, there's, I think the number is over 70, and every single character has their unique animation set.
That's crazy.
And that is amazing.
Yeah.
When you swap weapons around, that's when the animations start getting rehashed, but when you assign a character their preferred weapon, that's a full unique animation set.
Huh.
And it's, you know, the game doesn't look that amazing because you have to have thousands of things going on the screen at once, but the animation itself is really fluid and really fun.
Cool. Now tell me about Ambition Mode.
Okay. So Ambition Mode is where the thing I was talking about in my review about meaningful progression comes to play. So this isn't like a usual Dynasty Warriors game where it's just play these maps over and over and over again to collect the things or get the points. This is like you have a base and you're constantly adding to the base, getting new characters, getting new animals, getting new items, all kinds of stuff. And you're doing it in little bite-sized chunks. You, instead of huge battles with tons of objectives, you get to go out and play a small map with one, maybe two objectives.
Yeah.
And you do that and you get your reward. There's like points that you can give to upgrade your little shops that you get, or you can get new allies, or some other stuff. Sorry.
Not sure.
But basically, it feeds you stuff at a not too ridiculously grindy rate.
Cool.
And you get lots of growth that's noticeable.
Now it's named Ambition Mode. Does it have any like elements of Nobunaga's ambition in there? Like any sort of like territory control sort of army management stuff? None of that empire
terribly,
stuff?
It's mostly like build up your little hub and make the emperor happy.
So it feels very different from the previous games, like empires kind of stuff. It's a lot different than that.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah, it's Dynasty Warriors. It's really smooth. There's this ton of content.
Is this the Dynasty Warriors that is going to make people who hate Dynasty Warriors like Dynasty Warriors?
I would like to think so. I'm probably a little biased.
Yeah.
But if you're someone who's just been dismissing the series and not playing it for a while,
yeah,
I feel like if you show this person the game, maybe play it with them, they'll probably have some fun.
Yeah, if you find it super objectionable, that's a thing. But like, I know even I have one of those things where it's like, well, I like playing it, except for now I'm about 5 hours in and I realize I've just been hitting the X button for the last 3 hours and nothing's happened. Well, sometimes bars go up and sometimes I'm like,
oh, that
papers.
Reminds me. There's also a lot of new stuff in the combat that makes it more intelligent, for lack of a better word, immediately.
Yeah.
I'm
so it's not
a little bit.
Hit the button until you have Musou and then trigger Musou and then go back to hitting the button.
Right. First of all, I've always really felt that in Dynasty Warriors, mixing up your weak and strong attacks has been pretty important. But
yeah,
in this one, there's definitely a lot more emphasis on like if you hit the square button so many times, you're going to get a very unique move with your triangle button, and each one is going to kind of cover you for different situations. You've got crowd clearing, you have kind of one-on-one moves, there's some grappling stuff in there now, which is really
sweet.
There's
one-on-one in this game? Anytime
ever? I mean, when you're fighting an officer, it's pretty much one-on-one.
Sure.
Like, let's be real. And then there's this new weapon affinity. From what I've read, weapon switching was around in the last game where you could equip two different weapons to a character.
Yeah.
But apparently it didn't really do anything other than give you a different weapon.
Yep.
Now there's like a rock, paper, scissors type weapon affinity each weapon.
So at least you have to pay attention to who you're fighting and switch when you need to.
Yeah. And it works because when you are fighting someone with a different weapon affinity, it will change the difficulty. If you are fighting someone at an advantage to you, then you will be hurting pretty soundly. Like you'll get your butt kicked.
Hmm.
And the weapon switch also works as a counter. So it's just kind of these little extra additions that make the gameplay a bit more involved.
Yeah. Cool.
And then if you're fighting someone when you're at an advantage, you get like sweet auto combo thing that knocks off once you break their defenses down.
Yeah, guitar riffs. Do we get guitar riffs then?
Oh yeah. Lots of guitar riffs.
All right.
Cool. Looks like next up, Sean, you've been playing a little bit of another RPG class. We've been talking about RPGs, Earthbound. Well, mostly Earthbound. Shadowrun Returns.
Play the role of a guy who slashes stuff.
Well, I don't slash anything in Shadowrun Returns, but it is a very fun isometric RPG.
You're not a street samurai?
I am, but I use guns.
I don't understand.
Huh.
I wasn't given a sword yet.
You didn't? But you're a street samurai. You take it.
Well, I haven't found any swords.
What?
Oh, this is problematic for a street samurai.
I know. I don't either. I
think at this point you're just a street dude.
Well, I'm maybe.
In a really goofy outfit.
But yes.
I did upgrade to the ninja outfit.
Okay.
But still no sword.
Ninja toting around a machine gun. I'd like to see that.
Yeah, I am.
It's like a not machine see gun. That, 'cause it's ninja. Okay, so Shadowrun Returns. Tell us about it.
It's pretty fun. You have to. It's set in the Shadowrun universe. Really? So you have your humans, and then all the five races. Additionally, you build up your character. You pick a background and a class, and then you get to go to town customizing it. I could pick
which town?
Seattle.
Okay, that's more of a city. But continue.
Well, not now. Not in the Shadowrun world. It's more of a town.
Okay.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's got the campaign it comes with is pretty short, but it has the ability for anyone to pretty much make custom campaigns.
Yeah, so it's more of a, I guess, kind of like a Neverwinter Nights style thing.
Yeah.
Where it's designed for people to make adventures in it.
Yes, it's kind of like an isometric turn-based RPG version of Little Big Planet.
Hmm. That's actually kind of interesting.
You can place all sorts of stuff everywhere. You can build the dialogue and make your own little modules that people can play through.
You know, and given that
upload them onto Steam, and then people can download them.
Cool.
You know, given that's based on a pen and paper RPG, that's probably the best way they could have gone about it.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds just like a digital version of the pen and paper RPG.
Yeah.
Which is fine.
It'll be nice to see them. This one is really well. I like the atmosphere that this one, that the one that they ship with it comes with.
Yeah.
Or gives you. So I'd like to see them make more, like, chapters or something in that story.
Like official campaigns.
Yeah, I'd like to see more official campaigns, but I'm also interested to see what stuff people make for it.
The most crucial thing with that is to make sure that the best stuff bubbles to the top in the best way, and that's kind of something that we won't know for a while, but
yeah,
I hope so.
Well, the Steam Workshop generally does a pretty good job of sort of separating the wheat from the chaff.
Yeah. But it also does a good job of bringing up the, like, oh, this one brings, you know, you load this one and then you get all the achievements. And you load this one and, I don't know, things go crazy. So
another comparison to Little Big Planet.
Yes. Yes. I mean, really anything like that. Like, oh, well, I just get the, like, cheaty map. Okay, great. Thanks. But yeah, so I bet... I'm hoping there's some, like, staff curation, possibly.
That'd be nice.
So that, you know, they can look at them and hopefully... But, you know, I mean, I think the system is probably made so that it's fairly easy for people to, you know, realize their ideas in it.
Yeah, and I was a backer for it, so it did sound like, in a few of them, like they were planning on building more modules for it.
Yeah.
So we'll see how it goes.
Yeah.
It's got a lot of good tools and it's fun, so it'll be interesting to see where it goes.
Yeah. So you've actually been playing another game. Do you want to talk about that one?
Sure. I guess I could talk about the Raven.
Yeah.
He's also kind of a ninja.
What? Isn't he like a portly French man?
No. That's the guy trying to catch him, and he's Swiss.
Oh, okay. You're talking about the actual Raven. Okay.
Yeah, the master thief guy.
Okay. I was going to say, because in that game you play as a portly French man who is in no way a ninja. No, yes. He's Swiss.
He's Swiss.
Is he in France? Something's in France. Right?
No. There's a giant ruby stolen from London.
Okay.
And then you get on a train in Switzerland. The detective he's working with is French.
Okay.
But he's not the guy you are. He's the guy you're kind of helping.
Okay.
He's the guy that caught the original Raven.
Okay.
And killed him.
Whoa! What?
Yeah, no one was ever able to catch the Raven alive. He was stopped by shooting him.
Okay. So in this game,
you're chasing the Raven's successor.
Okay.
He is more violent than the original Raven. He sometimes lets off explosions when he's leaving. No one's been killed by him yet, but everyone wants to catch him because he's stealing giant rubies
and exploding things.
Yes, in museums, which are not
people want to
good
stop
for
people from
explosions.
Exploding things. Yeah.
So you are on a train,
protecting
an emerald, which is the same size as the ruby, on its way from Switzerland to Cairo.
Okay.
And so you basically go through the train, trying to make sure that he doesn't get in there and steal anything, and helping other people solve their problems along the way, kind of.
So, are there fail states, or are there times when you don't protect the gem and then it gets stolen?
I never failed, so I don't think so. Because I could have, if there was a way to fail, I would have.
Oh, Sean. But you're probably right. Okay, so it's not really like a danger packed thing as much as just following along the story.
No, it's more of a virtual novel meets a point-and-click action-adventure type of thing.
Wait, there's action?
No. Point-and-click adventure. The action all takes place in cutscenes. So there is some action.
Are there quick-time events?
Well, you get to see the explosions.
Are there quick-time events in the explosions?
No.
Good, because QuickTime events are the worst thing.
I wasn't sure which answer you wanted there.
I'm glad I picked the right one. Usually it's the QuickTime events are the worst thing. But no, anyway.
It's fun. The art style is very rich and vibrant and very exaggerated. So you can always tell. You can actually tell what emotion the characters you're interacting with are supposed to have.
Huh.
Because nice. You can. It's so exaggerated. It's almost abnormally so, but it's doesn't look bad because of the way the art is shaded and everything, I suppose.
Cool.
I like the portly Swiss guy.
Sorry.
Stop messing me up, man.
I really thought someone was French.
Yes, Lagrange. Legrand, he's the guy that shot the raven.
Okay.
I forgot his name. But he doesn't have, he has a, you're a Swiss guy who's helping him.
Okay.
And he looks like he's in his 50s-ish, maybe?
Yeah.
And he's not very funny. Like, he tries to tell jokes to people sometimes.
Yeah.
And they don't work. Kind of like my jokes. But it's just part of his charm, unlike with me.
You don't even get a funny comic relief sidekick?
No, not especially. He's kind of the sidekick, or is that's how it feels so far.
Yeah.
He's like the sidekick who's
Did you say sidekick?
No, I said sidekick. I just didn't say the D very well.
So he says sidekick.
He's not a psychic sidekick?
Oh, man, he's a sidekick.
Psychic sidekick.
He's a French psychic, right?
Swiss.
No, he's a psychic, so that he's probably also French, right? Secret French.
He might be. I don't know.
Fine.
You'll have to play to find out.
I will, and it seems fun.
It does seem fun, and there's going to be 3 episodes, I believe.
Okay.
So you'll get to see whether they actually ever catch the Raven's heir, or find out what happened to the ruby.
Cool.
I don't know what happened to it yet.
All right, let's move on. Hmm. Sounds cool.
All right. Last but not least, Graham, you have been playing Attack of the Friday Monsters on the 3DS.
I have. So
did you play it only on Friday?
No.
You really should have.
I played it between Fridays so that we could then run the review on Friday because I thought it would be funny. Attack of the Friday Monsters, A Tokyo Tale, which is not set in Tokyo. Don't ask me.
Oh.
It's set in like a random rural Japanese town. It's made by Millennium Kitchen, who has made the Boku no Natsuyasumi or My Summer Vacation series. We have gotten none of them in the West.
That makes me sad.
Because they're about a little Japanese kid in the summer in the 70s and about what that's like, which I guess, you know, I don't know. Guess it's not a super popular idea here, but yeah, I really wish we could get one of those games because there's the idea of those games is like the stakes are super low. It's just like living your life and like there's a lot of mechanics to that. There's a lot of things you can do and things you can see and you know, it's not like the game's simple. It's just that the game's stakes are really low in like a refreshing way. Like you're not saving the world. You're not saving a life. You are doing none of that. You're just hanging out.
If we can get Animal Crossing over here, or Harvest Moon, or The Sims, then surely a game like this can find its niche.
But at least those games, you know, like My Summer Vacation games end. Well, I'm just like it's a game with a beginning, a middle, and an end, and you can structure on that. It's not like a simulation, you know. Like it's a story. It's just a small, charming story. Anyway, so those take place over, you know, like a month or 2 months. Attack of the Friday Monsters takes place on Friday, one day. And it has all this, I mean, it has all these references to, you know, Japanese monster and hero things, you know, like kaiju, sentai stuff. But that is really not what the game's about. The game's about being in this town and hanging out with friends and exploring, you know, finding back paths, bothering adults and seeing what they're up to, playing dumb card games with friends, making up magic and acting like you're, you know, acting like you can make people fall down with a spell. I don't know. It's like a
it's about being a kid.
Yeah, it's like an earnest thing about childhood. Like, it's not making fun of it. It's not like it's just this. I don't know. It's just super pleasant. It's not very long. It's not a very long game. It's only a couple hours. Like maybe
it's one
four,
of the
but,
guild games, right?
Yes. So is one of the second wave of guild titles. They're calling them Black Box in the West, I think. Yeah. So this wraps up this season, because we already got Bugs versus Tanks and what was the
Starship Damry.
Starship Damry. I like the ideas of these games. I don't think these games would get made without this initiative. You know, it's these creators making interesting things. And like, as much as it's a short game without a whole bunch in it, what it does really well. I think that's been the weakness of a lot of guild titles, is maybe they either bite off a little more than they can chew, or just don't take the time they need to polish their mechanics. In the case of like Aeroporter, which is super frustrating from time to time. But this feels like it was a small thing that was executed exactly how well it needed to be. The one way I've been describing it to people is, you know how Ni No Kuni was like in this like Studio Ghibli world and like had that feel? This feels more like watching like a film, like a Ghibli film. Like, it has like a you know, like, I don't know, just endearing characters, and like it's very concentrated, and it wasn't like, hey, let's make it kind of feel like Dragon Quest and take all of your life. No, this is just it's an encapsulated experience, and I think it's a fun one.
Sounds awesome.
Yeah, it sounds quite lovely.
You should check it out, as long as you're not expecting like action, like anything related. I mean, the kids talk about monsters and heroes, but it's the kid lives in like the town where they film stuff, so it's like special effects and stuff, and all the parents are kind of lying to the kid to make him still like believe that it's real and stuff, but you're the kid, so you like it's interesting. Anyway, it's a good game. I could talk about it for longer than it takes to play it. You should just play it.
Is there any fun unlocky stuff if you have one of the other games?
So from what I can tell, the things you unlock are cards for the card game.
Okay.
Which that's fine. It speeds things up a little bit.
Because, I mean, it makes sense in a game like that, because yeah, what else could you do?
Yeah, it's just story.
Right.
But yeah, that, I don't know. It's a fun little touch, but it's not a huge deal. Anyway, all right. So hey, let's move on to our third segment. We're trying something new this time. We're calling it Retro Game Club. Each of us brings one game that didn't just come out. And we don't have to have a reason to talk about it. We just want to talk about it. And, then we talk about it and, the rest of us kind of talk to the person and find out more about that game. And just really, really appreciate these things that are long gone but still with us. Yeah.
All right. Should I go first?
Yeah. You seem to have something interesting you want to say about your game.
Yeah, so...
Oh boy!
I'm here to talk about Superman 64.
Why?
Yeah.
Because there are certain things about bad games that have lots of merit in certain situations.
Okay. This is gonna be an interesting one. Let's see what you got.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I have a story here, if you guys don't mind a bit of story time.
Okay, it's story time.
Story time. Gather around in a semicircle, kids. It's time for story time.
I'm already in a semicircle.
Fairly recently, I had my engagement party.
Yeah,
I got engaged a few months ago, and so
congratulations.
We're doing that. And
how did you rope Superman 64 into your engagement party?
That sounds pretty. Yeah.
Okay, it's actually kind of a
you're still getting married.
Tragic. Yeah.
Okay.
Eventually, maybe not to the same person anymore, but We kind of had this thing at a neighborhood kind of clubhouse, whatever you want to call it. And, you know, people are over having food and stuff. And I brought my old video games over. So
yeah,
there could be, because, you know, I have a lot of gaming friends. And I didn't want it to be the center of attention, so I didn't bring the new stuff. I just, well, let's throw the NES and the SNES over here. And if anyone wants to tool around, that's fine.
Yeah.
The Super Nintendo decided it didn't want to turn on anymore, which was very sad. But my brother was there, and he has been building his Nintendo 64 collection. So he's a few years younger than me, so he was kind of right in the N64 area. So that's his big nostalgia thing.
Right.
So he had his big collection, and me and my friends were kind of going through them and thinking, wow, it sure was good that we were children when we had this thing, because most of these games are terrible.
Accurate.
And, yeah. Accurate. And I noticed, holy crap, there's Superman 64. Why do you have this? And so we threw it in, just for giggles. And I had never actually experienced it before. You know, everyone talks about how it's the worst game ever and all that fun Superman 64 stuff. So
it's probably not the worst game ever.
Yeah, but
you it's know, up there.
It has its reputation.
Yeah.
So we're playing it, and you know, it's Superman careening wildly in the sky, trying to go through a line of rings because Lex Luthor says so. And it's as it is, but it was kind of turning into like this almost spectator sport. Like, we had just a line of people crowded around the TV. Like, we had a line of chairs, so we had like a line of people who were going to take their turn next, and then we had other people who like weren't even interested in the video games before, like crowding around, and people were like, oh my god, he almost made it, and all that, you know, fun stuff. And
yeah,
it was a lot of fun just to kind of sit here and share this moment of a terrible game with a room full of people.
Yeah.
And then, like, my brother, who had actually played it before, he beat it. And then, you know, everyone cheered, the room exploded. And then the next level, you have like 5 seconds to throw like 4 cars for some reason. And of course, he failed that. And we're just like, no. And then I said, hey, I noticed that the menu said multiplayer.
What?
Who wants to try this with me?
Oh, no.
I didn't even know that game had multiplayer, because I try not to pay attention to
it. I think I suppressed the memory.
And this is where things get kind of weird.
Okay.
So before that, as we were going through the line of N64 games, we played Forsaken 64.
Well, that was...
Yeah, it's this weird kind of battle bike hover thing. You're like flying around in first person, shooting at each other. Nothing makes any sense. Everything's all turgid, and it's
even less so.
Yeah. Maybe so
more so.
We jump into the multiplayer of Superman 64, and I kid you not, it's a copy of Forsaken 64 with Superman characters.
Well,
it could be worse.
It could
be much worse.
Except it's like Forsaken 64 bad. That doesn't actually, like, it works less than Forsaken 64.
So it's the RIPD, the game of N64 games.
Yeah. It is something else. And then there's like a battle mode, and then there's like a race mode where like you follow this slow moving vehicle as it spits rings out, and you're supposed to do something. Anyway, the point is that we were playing this game that's supposedly terrible, and it sucked up a good 40 minutes of time. And we got like the whole room watching the stupid game.
Yeah.
Really into it. And it was just a pretty special moment for me.
Yeah.
And my brother was there, and like my mom was there watching us being kind of afraid. And, you know, all my friends and everything. And it was just for something like that to come out of a notoriously bad video game kind of adds a lot to the medium as something more than just like a toy that you play around with and then move on to the next thing.
Yeah. Even the worst games have their, you know, their potential for fun. There are things there.
Exactly.
Yeah. They just have to have the right context. Admittedly, Superman 64 doesn't have a lot of contexts, but it had that one. So, you know, hey,
exactly.
Yeah.
Plus it's always fun, like you said, to just, care into a game that's notoriously bad. I mean, it's the same reason that people watch movies like The Room or Birdemic or stuff like that. Yeah. It's just sometimes fun to get together with your friends and laugh at how bad something is.
Yeah. Or even, like, you know, if you set the bar at the lowest possible, you know, it
all that's left to go is up.
Yeah. Like, once you have zero expectations for something, anything that is at all amusing is great.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Say so.
Yeah. Thank you for your story. That was a good one.
Yay.
I was happy to tell it.
Yay.
Right, who's next?
I can go.
All right. Well, yeah.
So, I have this game. I don't know if any of you guys have played it.
I had never even heard of it before you said it.
I've heard of it.
I played a little bit of it.
It's Car Battler Joe.
Yeah.
That's a cool name for a game.
So Car Battler Joe has a lot going for it because it is a car battle RPG.
A car PG?
Okay. Virtual high five without the lead up. I just missed it.
Yes, I did.
Yeah, so it kind of came after this wave of making everything like Pokemon. So they're like, hey, how about we make like cards like Pokemon? So what you do is you enter like battles, but battles are kind of like little instants, like almost Twisted Metal style, small like Mode 7 arenas. And Game Boy Advance, where you go around and you have like equipped weapons and like you've built your car out of parts. So, like you have different characteristics. Sometimes you're faster. Sometimes you're better at turning. Sometimes you can take more damage. And you either have to destroy enemies or like get through an area while not being blown up or things like that. And so it uses that mechanic both from like traveling from town to town. There's no overworld. There's just driving from place to place and like having these. I mean, it's almost open world in a way. Like you go through an area and you don't know whether you're going to have to take on something, which is interesting. And then when you get there, you get into tournaments where you know you can build up your car and I don't know. It's an interesting game. But what it has going for it is it was made by Ancient, which is Yuzo Koshiro's company.
I never knew that.
Yeah, so his company mostly just does, you know, music for games. But it made Car Battler Joe, and it made an Xbox Live indie game called Protect Me Night that I have sold as much as I possibly can to you guys, so you need to go ahead and play it. But
really
this was kind of the first.
Fantastic.
It's kind of the first like full, you know, Protect Me Night was a small project. Car Battler Joe was this huge thing. It was localized by Natsume, so dialogue not great.
So this is a game that came out outside of Japan.
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so yeah, you can totally play this game. I'll try not to tell you guys about imports in Retro Game Club. Anyway. So yeah.
You mentioned that Yuzo Koshiro wrote the soundtrack, right?
Yeah,
or at least this is
his company made everything. So yeah, so he did the soundtrack for this game, and it's pretty cool. I mean, it's more akin to his, you know, Streets of Rage style, you know, using weird sound chips to make music style. But hey, I mean, that's some of his best work.
Yeah, that's his distinctive style. Yeah,
He's definitely moved on now to doing some more lush orchestration. But yeah, so that part's really cool. You basically just need to skip all the dialogue, but it feels a little. I guess maybe if you liked the kind of overworld and story in something like Mega Man Battle Network, it feels a little childish at times, and the dialogue seems kind of dumb a lot. But you are, you know, chasing your dad who's been away for a while and left you this stuff so you can start being a car battler, and you know, it's whatever. It's in this shadow of Pokemon thing, but I don't know.
There's something to be said for RPG comfort food.
Yeah, and shooting things with cars, like, you know, it's like
that's also nice.
It's kind of like it feels a little Mario Kart, like Super Mario Kart battle mode kind of, because you're moving around an area kind of that big and shooting things at other cars, and I don't know. There's a lot to it that's definitely worth checking out.
It's not masterpiece or anything, but it's pretty fun.
It kind of makes me think of Power Quest for the Game Boy Color, even though
we're
looking at totally different genres.
I have not heard of that game. What is that game?
It's this weird game I like.
Style game?
No. It was this game I tripped over practically in the Game Boy Advance. It's like a kind of Pokemon-esque RPG where all the kids have robots.
Okay.
And you kind of build your robot out of there's like different characters, and then when you go to fight your robots with it, it's like a fighting game. And I don't know, it doesn't really have any, it just kind of reminds me.
It reminds me of like Custom Robo or maybe Metabots.
Is it like Biomoto Unitron or Robopon or something like that?
Biomoto Unitron is pretty straightforward. It's more traditional.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah.
But the idea of like taking the kind of Pokemon outer structure and then kind of turning it into a different genre.
If you have played Custom Robo, that's pretty close because it is kind of these like instance battles, but you're building a thing to bring into it.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, I don't know. It's maybe, if you're ever bored, track down Carbattler 2.
Sure.
Yeah.
But, hey Sean, what are you going to talk about?
I'm going to talk about a game where there are mechs beating the heck out of each other.
Okay. You got me.
Ooh. Yeah.
And also hitting, spherical objects a mile and then running around bases and scoring runs.
Oh, wait. So baseball.
Yes, baseball with mechs.
Okay.
Well, that's not really mechs. They're more like robots.
Okay.
Because there's no one inside them.
That's not as cool.
But this is Base Wars.
Okay.
It's a game where if the ball isn't caught, the only way you can get out is by being beaten up by the guy with the ball.
Baseball should be played.
Yeah.
Also, you can bring weapons with you. So you can have people with, arms that can shoot off your body. Rocket hands.
Okay.
Let's go with that.
Yeah, rocket hands.
Laser swords.
I like that. Yeah.
And also the ability to just run them over with a tank.
But that seems effective.
Yes.
So I know that baseball is... I know that Base Wars was a part of this movement to make sports games that were also kind of crazy.
Yes.
Do you know where it fell on that scheme? Was it kind of near the end, or was it one of the first to really try this kind of stuff?
It was the first one I heard about.
Okay.
But I don't know where the others were. It came out way back when. The only thing I knew about video games was that you had Mario and you could jump on things, and Sonic could spin in circles.
Okay.
Was this an NES game then?
This was an NES game.
Okay. Yes, indeed.
So I actually didn't even discover that Tecmo had sports games until after I played Base Wars.
Okay, well, that must have been a very strange entry into
sports. Yes, it was my first sports game. But it was a lot of fun. It had, you could set up leagues where you played with other people. You could set up every single team to be human if you wanted to, or
cool,
or you could play a computer. And if every robot had HP, so if they got beat up too many times, they would break, and they were an automatic out whenever they came up to bat for the rest of the game. If you had three robots get broken too much, then you lost the game. You forfeited, whether you were winning or not. You're going to be winning 16-0. If you lose three robots, you lose.
So basically, if the computer is beating you pretty badly on the scoreboard, you just beat them up really badly on the field.
Yes. And so whenever you won, you got a certain amount of money for winning, which you could use to upgrade your robots or fix them if they had been damaged. And there were a number of different models. There were humanoid cyborgs. There was hover robots, and then there were tanks, and my favorites were the hover ones.
How can your favorites not be tanks?
Because
sounds pretty robust for a Nintendo game.
Because the hover ones could hover up in the air. They had two different levels. They had the base level, then you could, whenever they were in a fight, you could hover a little bit higher and then drop down on top of them.
Okay.
And just crush them over and over and over and over again.
But yeah, so Lucas, you mentioned that it's a robust game. It was a super late life NES game, wasn't it? It came out in 1991.
I believe so.
And it was a Konami title. They put it out under the Ultra label, but you know, it wasn't some fly by night crazy person. It was pretty solid developer making that game.
Yeah, and Ultra actually made a number of their games, I believe, for the Super Nintendo or the NES that were, I think, a lot of people liked a number of them.
Yeah, well, again, it was Ultra was one of those smoke and mirrors.
Labels. Each publisher can only put out five games a year, so hey, it was just Konami shuffling some paper.
I would even say maybe the games that Konami put out under the Ultra label maybe were generally better than the ones. I'm hesitant to say that.
They put out Qbert.
Ultra did. Metal Gear and Snake's Revenge and TMNT. Yeah, so. I mean, didn't have Castlevania, but doing some pretty good stuff. So it wasn't like the B-tier labels. It was much just like maybe even more Western-style games feels maybe like that was the distinction. Who knows?
Yeah.
Anyway, but Base Wars is pretty cool.
Yes. Also, if you hit people with the pitch, they also lost HP. So if they were killing you, then yeah, you could just hit everyone in over and over and over again until they lost it, until they ran out of HP and died.
Sure. Sean, did you ever play Super Baseball 2020?
I did.
So
that became my favorite sports game after Base Wars.
Yeah, because it also has robots. It's not all robots. It's kind of a prequel.
Yeah, that was the one thing I didn't like about that game.
Was it some of the more robots?
No, I actually didn't mind them being robots.
Okay.
My problem with that game was the fact that you could be playing a league, and if you didn't win every single game, you would lose the league because it made up everyone else's stats and rankings. Mm. Because you'd go through there and like, oh, look, these guys have lost three games, and then you lose a game the next game. Oh, look, they're undefeated now.
Yeah. Oh, well. Anyway. Hey, Chris, you got a game you want to talk about?
Oh, yes, I do.
What's the game?
It's a game that I personally feel to be the greatest 8-bit RPG ever made.
Okay.
Phantasy Star.
Wait, so it's a game I haven't played yet?
I guess not, yeah.
So, yeah, the original Phantasy Star doesn't get a heck of a lot of you know, attention now. I think a lot of the attention is paid to 2 and 4.
Yeah, pretty much. But and the original was shame.
It was a super old school first person, you know, really, it was not much of a JRPG. It was much more similar to the PC RPGs, like, you know, early 80s kind of stuff. Really more Western, I say, than,
That's a funny thing about it. In gameplay mechanics, yes, I would totally agree. It borrows a whole lot from Wizardry and Ultima, stuff like that. The dungeons are first person. The overworld looks a lot like full-color version of Ultima. But in the actual story, in the actual art direction, and pretty much everything else that isn't the game mechanics, I'd actually argue that it's one of the first titles that really set the boundaries for what defines a JRPG.
Yep. I mean, crazy stuff in space. Crazy stuff.
Very well said.
Yeah. But, doesn't try to, hew toward, Western dark fantasy. I mean, especially like the Western translations of Dragon Warrior games and stuff like that were super like Arthurian.
Super cheesy.
Yeah, so this was space and crazy costumes and crazy monsters and it didn't try to be really anything that came before it in a way that we've kind of seen in a lot of games afterward, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. Also, one thing I really have to mention, just the presentation of the game itself. Now, it was coded by Yuji Naka, and it's just unbelievable to look at. The dungeons are in complete full screen, first person dungeon crawling, which is completely unheard of on consoles and even PCs at the time. Most of the time, if there was a first person RPG, it was super jerky frame by frame, only took up maybe a third of the screen, but this It really showed off what the Master System could do.
Yeah.
With full screens, massive dungeons, and the battles also took place in first person. The enemies had a series of animations, which was just jaw dropping to look at.
Yeah.
Especially some of the later ones, and the use of color in the game. It really uses the Master System's distinctive color palette really right. well. Everything's so lush and vibrant. It is just gorgeous to look at. Just gorgeous. Yeah. Oh, and the soundtrack. it was one of the few games to use the Japanese Sega Mark III's FM synthesis sound chip. So the Japanese version of the game actually has notably superior music. Try listening to the difference sometime. It's sounds like you're listening to a Genesis game instead of a Master System game.
Do you know if the Phantasy Star Collection on the GBA, do you know if it uses the enhanced sound?
Unfortunately, it does not. It uses chiptunes. But there was a reworked and ROM hack release.
Yeah.
A while. Oh, sorry, can I talk about that?
It's fine.
Remember,
kids. Don't play games you don't own. But if you own the game and you want to play it with different sound, sure, that's fine.
Yeah, that's what Graham said. But anyway, there was a re-released retranslation of the game, and it added in the FM sound, and that was the. I played it again after I played the original Master System version, and the difference is just night and day. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
It really makes the game shine to its full potential.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting talking about this, kind of how it was really impressive for its time, and it definitely was. And you mentioned the Master System color palette. That when you look back at Master System games, there's something about them that they just seem brighter and happier and more lush, and like it's very pleasant, the effect that the color palette had on those games. But for now, you know, like if people are playing it now, and I think there's a lot of people who haven't played the first Phantasy Star yet, does it hold up particularly well, or is it kind of one of those things where you go in it as like a relic of its time and embrace that?
Okay, here's my best advice for going into Phantasy Star and getting the full enjoyment out of it.
Okay.
First off, stick with it through the first hour of the game or so.
Okay.
What probably the game's biggest flaw is that in the first part of the game, you're going to have to be very, very careful and have to grind for quite a while. Maybe you grind a few levels or so before you can venture outside the main compound of the game. And that's very frustrating, and it's probably the part of the game that most shows its age, but once you get past that, you really start getting into a groove and what you should do, and the game really opens itself up, and the difficulty becomes much more manageable. Second piece of advice, do not be afraid to use a guide. Because this is probably a game with its labyrinth and dungeons, its first-person perspective inside those dungeons, that requires either you grab a huge thing of graph paper or
graph paper,
graph paper, the greatest tool of classic RPGs fan could have.
I don't even like it for RPGs. I just like it, man.
You would like graph paper.
It's pretty great.
Satisfying.
I never want to see it again after having to use it for math classes.
Proportional of things is great. You keep everything exactly the ratio it needs to be. It's wonderful.
This is probably, like I said, this is probably a game where you'll have to bust out the guide every now and then so you don't get lost. It's another thing that probably makes it kind of dated when compared to modern RPGs, but I really dare you to find an 8-bit console RPG that wasn't. This and Phantasy Star probably holds up, in fact, a lot better than most 8-bit RPGs just because...
That's fair. Man, 8-bit RPGs.
It's so engaging in so many other ways.
Yeah.
So if you're going to play Phantasy Star, then those are my two big pieces of advice on how to get the most out of the game. And
are there any big story points in the first one that would be really nice to know and would really like enhance playing something like 2 or 4 and
well, actually,
not 3 under any circumstances?
I'm very glad you asked. 2, not so much 3, and 4 actually do borrow some callbacks and stuff to the original game. Phantasy Star 2, in fact, its opening cutscene is a reference to the final battle in the original Phantasy Star.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. And I think one thing that really gets overlooked in the original Phantasy Star in regards to its story is it's one of the first big games to really feature a female protagonist. I mean, we obviously have Samus, but Samus
people mostly didn't know that. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It was kind of shoehorned in at the last minute, whereas Alice, the main hero in Phantasy Star, right there from the beginning, she was the main character throughout the entire game. And if they actually had the space and the capacity to expand on the story, I think that she would have been regarded as one of the great female characters of gaming. I really think that it deserves a lot of credit.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so we are probably running a little long here, so I'm gonna go ahead and wrap up. I think, you know, I really enjoyed this discussion that we had, but you know, if you guys, you know, if you enjoy listening to us doing this retro game club thing, we'll definitely bring it back in the future. Just let us know what you think. But yeah, next episode, we're going to be able to talk about a few big releases. Pikmin 3, Tales of Vesilia, Dragon's Crown. We got some interesting thing happening. But until then, for Lucas, Chris, and Sean, I'm Graham. See ya.
Thanks for listening to the Snack Bar Games Podcast. Follow us on the web at snackbar-games.com or on Twitter at snackbargames.